It's November 1915 in the Antarctic. Men are huddled together with their sleigh dogs in the most inhospitable barren landscape imaginable. It's unbearably cold in this snow-covered landscape, and a cruel wind only adds to their suffering. They've been stranded for months. Their ship, the Endurance, have become trapped in the ice, with no way of freeing it and no way of contacting the civilized world. Their only hope was to wait for the ice to thaw. But as time progressed, the ice, in its unforgiving progress, began to attack the ship's hull. As they stare at it now, it's listing to the left. They are helpless to stop this slow motion sinking, which has taunted them for weeks. As they watch, they know it can't be long. It must soon go. The groan of the ship and a crack of the ice shakes the very ground they stand on. And then it happens. The ship sinks, swallowed into the icy depths below, consumed by the ice. They are 800 miles from the nearest humans. Surely all is lost. But among the 28 men is their leader, a man called Ernest Shackleton. And despite a hopeless situation and the prospect of certain death only a short time away, with Shackleton's remarkable leadership, all 28 men were to survive. Ernest Shackleton was one of the most remarkable leaders to have ever lived. The story of his expedition to cross the Antarctic coast to coast is one of the most unbelievable tales of endurance and survival. Hi, I'm Shane Lee, and this is the Enduring Lives podcast, where we explore the lives and enduring legacies of some of the world's most extraordinary people. In this episode, we are exploring the life of Ernest Shackleton. If you want to find all the previous episodes of the podcast, or if you want to see the show notes with the sources for this episode, head over to enduringlives.com. And if you have 5 minutes to let us know what you think by leaving a review of the podcast wherever you're listening, please do. It would really help the show. Join me as we explore the enduring life of Ernest Shackleton. Ernest Henry Shackleton was born on the 15th of February, 1874 in Kilkea, Ireland. He was the first son and second child out of 10 in total of his parents, Henry Shackleton and Henrietta Gavan. Henry Shackleton was a farmer when Ernest was born, but changed careers to become a doctor when Ernest was 6. This led the family to move to Dublin, where his father was studying medicine. When Ernest was 10 years old, the family moved again, this time to Sydenham, in London. As a child, Ernest was an avid reader. During his childhood, there was a publication called The Boy's Own Paper, which was a publication aimed at young boys. It was a particular favourite of his, and some biographers have suggested that this publication may have given young Ernest a yearning for adventure. The paper published many stories, including nautical adventures. One of the serialized stories that was published was Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, which tells the adventure of Captain Nemo and his underwater ship called the Nautilus. Ernest didn't attend school until he was 11 and a half. Prior to that, he was educated by a governess. The first school was Fir Lodge Prep School, which he attended until he was 13 in 1887, when he moved to Dulwich College. By all accounts, Ernest found his schoolwork dull and boring, and he was said to be involved in scraps whenever they occurred. He developed a reputation as a rule breaker, who could get away without punishment. When he was frequently late to class, he would be let off scot-free because of his ability to tell wild and captivating stories that he made up on the spot about why he was late. Henry Shackleton, Ernest's father, wanted Ernest to follow in his footsteps in the medical profession. But the young Ernest, by now 16 years old, yearned for adventure. It may have been his reading that inspired him, but the young Ernest wanted to leave school and go to the sea. Joining the Royal Navy was the typical route for a young man wanting to go to sea. But Ernest was too old to become a cadet, as the entry limit was 14 and a half. Even if he was younger, there were financial issues that would have prevented him from joining. To train for the Royal Navy on the cadet training ship, the Britannia, cost £70 per year. It only cost £15 per year to go to Dulwich College. So instead, he joined the Merchant Navy. His father got him a berth on a ship called the Hogton Tower for 1 shilling a month. The ship was owned by the North Western Shipping Company of Liverpool. Before setting sail, Shackleton had to complete one more term at Dulwich, which he did with a not-before-seen zeal. He left school near the top of his class, a feat he had not accomplished before. In April, he left school for good, headed for Liverpool, bound for adventure. His first voyage took him to Valparaiso and around Cape Horn in South America. Places we learned in a previous episode of the podcast that Charles Darwin had visited on his legendary voyage on the Beagle. This first voyage exposed Shackleton to the hardships of the sea. The ship was often battered by storms, during which he was often 30 foot up in the air, working in the sails of the ship. It wasn't just hard, it was dangerous. After around a year at sea, they made it back to Liverpool in April 1891. It was here that Shackleton made the decision to continue with the Merchant Navy and train to become an officer, despite the hardships of a life at sea. In doing so, he signed himself away for a minimum of 4 difficult years at sea. Over the next 3 years, Shackleton sailed multiple times to South America and back, each time learning more, moving ever closer to becoming an officer. He attained the rank of second mate in August 1894. He was 20 years old. He was now an officer in the Merchant Navy. During his time sailing, Shackleton, like in his youth, preferred to spend his spare time reading. Unlike the other men he sailed with, Shackleton refrained from visiting the working women on shore leave. But there was one woman, and for Shackleton, she was the woman. Her name was Emily Dorman, and she was a friend of one of his sisters. They had met during the summer of 1897, and in the final days of that year, Shackleton's ship ran aground near Middlesbrough, and Shackleton used this twist of fate to take 24 hours shore leave on the guise of wishing his father happy birthday. But he was really going to see Emily to tell her that he loved her. By 1898, Shackleton had attained and surpassed the rank of first mate, becoming a master, which granted him the right to command a British ship anywhere in the world. By this time, he had moved on to a new ship with the same company called the Flintshire. But it was clear that Shackleton harboured greater ambitions. He worried that if he stayed with the company, he would become a captain and do nothing remarkable with his life. After a couple more years and another promotion, in September 1900, Shackleton saw his chance to become an adventurer and an explorer. Ideas which he had lusted after since his earliest years, when he had read stories of such daring spirits. He applied to join the National Antarctic Expedition. The National Antarctic Expedition was the first official British expedition to the Antarctic for over 60 years. It was led by Captain Robert Falcon Scott, its aims scientific and geographic. The funding had mainly come from the Royal Society and the Royal Geographic Society, as well as the British government. The ship for this expedition was aptly called the Discovery. For many, this was the expedition that would launch the Great Age of polar exploration. It came at the end of the Victorian era and at the start of the Edwardian period. For Shackleton, it was to be his first taste of polar adventure. The Discovery set sail from the Thames on the 31st of July 1901. It would take them 162 days, nearly half a year of sailing, including visits to Cape Town and New Zealand, before they arrived at the coastline of Antarctica on the 9th of January 1902. In early February, they landed at a newly discovered peninsula, which they named King Edward VII Land, after the newly crowned King of England. In the spirit of the age of exploration, and in order to survey the land, Captain Scott had brought a balloon that he wanted to use for the purpose. The balloon was inflated with hydrogen in order to get lift. The ship's assistant surgeon, Edward Wilson, thought that attempting to fly in it was a mad and dangerous idea. Nevertheless, Scott, after having tethered the balloon to the ground, took the first flight, ascending to 600 foot. Shackleton took the second flight. The ship's crew had nicknamed the balloon Eva. While Edward Wilson was right to call the idea dangerous, given tears quickly developed in the fabric of the balloon and the hydrogen valve was unsafe, it wasn't the first time that a balloon had been used in polar expeditions. There was a failed Swedish expedition to the North Pole in 1897 that used a balloon to travel. A few days later, they sailed a little further, looking for a place to moor the ship for the length of the expedition. They found it, an area called Winter Quarters Bay, which again was named on this expedition. Their intention was to set up the ship, let it be frozen in over the winter, and use it as a base for the scientific and exploratory work of the expedition. One of the major feats of the expedition was that a small party of men, Scott, Shackleton and Wilson, were to make it to the furthest point south that any human had reached at that point. What made the feat all the more remarkable was how ill-prepared and experienced any of them were for the challenge. It was perhaps Shackleton's first real experience of true hardship. For one thing, they were not experienced with skis. This meant that they were wasting precious energy by not using them correctly. For another, they were poor dog handlers and overloaded the dogs that were pulling them. To make matters worse, they messed up the food, particularly the dogs, which had gone green with mould. When they returned from the journey in February 1903, after several months, they all had symptoms of scurvy. At least one of the dogs had been shot to feed the others. And then the rest of the dogs eventually died. And Shackleton himself had to be dragged back for a large part of the return journey on a sled. Nevertheless, they managed to beat the previous record of having been the furthest south by some 200 miles. One of the things the men did to keep up their morale during the journey was read to each other. One of the books favoured by Scott was The Origin of Species by Charles Darwin, who we have previously covered on this podcast. They arrived back in Portsmouth, England in September 1903. For his part in the expedition, Shackleton was promoted to a captain and invited to Balmoral Castle to meet King Edward VII, where Shackleton was given the rank of commander in the Royal Victorian Order, which was one rank away from being knighted. When Shackleton originally set sail on the expedition, he had written a letter to Emily Dorman's father, the girl for whom he had declared his love. He asked in the letter for his permission to marry Emily. While on the expedition, her father died, leaving her with a good income of £700 per year, and the decision of whether to marry Shackleton. She decided to marry him. While the income of Emily's would have supported them fine, Shackleton did not like the idea of living off his wife's money, so he started looking for a job. While he had been on the expedition, Shackleton assumed the responsibility of editing the magazine of the expedition called the South Polar Times. After returning home, Shackleton took this experience and temporarily became a journalist for the Royal Magazine. He was also commissioned to write two articles for the Illustrated London Times about the expedition. He didn't keep up the journalism for long, however, as he found it boring like his school days. He managed to secure a position as secretary for the Royal Scottish Geographical Society. This required him to move to Edinburgh, which he did, leaving Emily in London whilst he set up things in the city. In April, they were married in Christchurch, Westminster, and then they both moved to Edinburgh. Members of the Discovery Expedition found that after they returned, there was a demand for lectures about their adventure. Shackleton completed a few lectures and found that he had a talent for public speaking, which may not have come as much of a surprise given his popularity with his various ship crews and his ability from his school days to talk himself out of punishments. It was partly his skill in making speeches and his ability to hold an audience that led him to resign from the Royal Scottish Geographical Society in January 1905 and stand for election to Parliament. He stood for the Dundee constituency as a representative for the Liberal Union Party. He was unsuccessful, which is perhaps lucky in hindsight, as his name was really made with his subsequent expeditions, particularly the Endurance Expedition. If he had ended up living a life of politics, who knows if his life would have been an enduring one. Following his failed attempt to break into the world of politics, Shackleton and an old school friend, George Petries, saw an opportunity to make their fortune. The Russo-Japanese War had just ended with a Russian defeat. The chance to make money, as they saw it, was by renting ships to the Russian government to charter the Russian soldiers back home to Russia, as Russia did not have enough of its own ships for the purpose. Shackleton called this his little steamboat company, and was convinced that he was about to be a rich man following the success of the scheme. While it seemed to Shackleton a certainty, the venture went nowhere. They had none of their own boats, and they didn't manage to make it work. When Shackleton found himself again in want of employment, he managed to become employed by a wealthy man called William Beardmore, during which time Shackleton had started to yearn again for adventure, and particularly the South Pole. It wasn't the only thing he yearned for. It is rumoured that Shackleton had started having an affair with William's wife. In planning his new expedition, Shackleton presented the journey as a business opportunity and managed to secure £7,000 in funding from Beardmore on the agreement that Beardmore would be paid first from the profits from the venture. Although some biographers have hinted that Beardmore funding this may have simply been a way to get Shackleton away from his wife. This new expedition was officially called the British Antarctic Expedition, but is often simply referred to as the Nimrod Expedition, after the ship they sailed on. For Shackleton, the main objective of the undertaking was to be the first explorer to reach the South Pole, a feat that no human, as yet, had accomplished. The expedition was poorly funded and nearly saw the end before it even began. One of the people Shackleton had secured funding from, Douglas Stewart, pulled out at the last minute. This meant that they could not acquire the ship that Shackleton originally wanted, called the Bjorn. Shackleton was not one to give up, however. He soon found another ship, albeit in a worse state than the Bjorn. It was called the Nimrod, Although Shackleton wanted to change its name to the Endurance, which was a reference to his family motto, "By Endurance We Conquer," he didn't end up changing the name. Perhaps because of the old superstition of seagoing men, that renaming a ship is bad luck. In any case, it wasn't until the 7th of August 1907 that the Nimrod set sail from London, bound for the South Pole. It left without Shackleton, however, as he intended to stay behind for a few months, intending to secure the remaining financing. It took until October when he finally left London to catch up with the ship that had not reached Antarctica yet. When Shackleton reached Australia, the expedition was once more nearly killed because some of the funding he had secured in London was cancelled because of reported American bank failures. Still, he persevered. Shackleton met an eminent professor at Adelaide University called Edgeworth David, who managed to persuade the then Australian Prime Minister, Alfred Deakin, to cover the funding gap. It was early 1908 when they arrived at Cape Royds on Ross Island in Antarctica. This would be their base for the next few months, while they prepared for the unforgiving trek to the pole. One of the interesting points of this expedition was they took a motor car with them with the intention of driving it in Antarctica. They were the first to do this, although it can hardly be called a success. They unloaded the car, had several attempts at starting it, finally got it running, found out that they couldn't drive on the snow, and put it back on the ship. Although they did use it again later, during their time at Cape Royds. In March, Shackleton decided, with very little notice, that they were going to attempt to be the first party to summit the volcano Mount Erebus. They didn't have any climbing equipment to aid them in their climb, but nevertheless, they improvised some crampons and determined to reach the 12,000 foot peak. It took them over 5 days, but they made it, apart from Philip Brocklehurst, who decided to turn back because of altitude sickness. As winter was drawing in on the southern hemisphere, the men were staying in a prefabricated hut on Cape Royds. Attempting to reach the pole in the middle of an Antarctic winter was a fool's game. They would wait until the winter ended. The hut in which they stayed was small for a party of 14 men on the expedition. So small that their dining table was attached to a pulley system that could be raised out of the way when they weren't using it. The winter was harsh. One of the men, Brocklehurst, had gotten frostbitten on his big toe, which he got while climbing Erebus. But as the winter progressed, it got worse until it had to be amputated. It wasn't until Tuesday, October the 29th, when Shackleton set out to lead a small group of men to the South Pole. Shackleton and the men were brimmed with optimism, buoyed by the perfect weather conditions, a blue sky without a cloud in sight. Shackleton's previous experience on the Discovery and the lessons learned were clearly paying off. 9 days in, they had covered 54 miles compared to 37 miles in the first 9 days of the Discovery attempt from several years prior. Still, the distance they had to cover was vast and difficult. From their starting point in Cape Royds, the South Pole was a distance of 747 miles. With the rations of food they could carry, this meant they had to average 16 miles a day. Despite the improvement, they were behind schedule, and being behind schedule could mean the difference between life and death. Instead of travelling with dogs this time, they were travelling with ponies. While horses are stronger than dogs, their size can be a disadvantage. In one instance, a pony fell down a crack and had to be rescued. Whereas a dog could have been easily rescued, it took the combined efforts of three men to free the animal. They were wasting precious energy. Ponies were also more susceptible to the cold than dogs. Each night the men would have to waste more energy rubbing them down, covering them with blankets, and building snow walls to protect them from the harsh elements. They managed to keep going. By the 25th of November, they had surpassed Shackleton's own previous record for reaching the furthest point south, and they were still going. By their calculations, it was going to take another month at least before they reached the pole. One of the men, Frank Wilde, wrote in his diary that he did not doubt they would reach the pole, but he did doubt the chances of their safe return. It was fair to doubt their chances because one of the ponies had already had to be put down with a revolver because of damage from the cold. Their only solace was that this meant they had more meat and rations. By December, they were down to their last pony of the four they took. Socks, the pony, was the last survivor. In the first days of the month, the party reached one of the biggest obstacles they had faced, the Beardmore Glacier, which was some 125 miles long. They were the first to discover it, and it was named in honour of the William Beardmore, who you may remember had contributed towards the financing of the expedition. Crossing the glacier was treacherous. Any step could be their last. Vast crevasses sat below bridges of snow that could collapse at any moment. Frank Wilde was to learn this firsthand. After a few days marching on the glacier, Frank and Socks fell through the snow. Frank managed to cling on to the edge and was saved in the nick of time by Shackleton and the others. But Socks was gone. This meant now the men had to increase their burden by carrying the load between them that Socks had been pulling. To add to their woes, their rations were running low, and they were having to eat fewer calories each day. It was not looking good. By the 19th of December, they were struggling with the ice. Any mild incline on the glassy surface proved difficult to climb. Combined with their lack of food, the increased difficulty of the terrain was starting to grind away at the men, and they were beginning to argue with each other. On Christmas, one of the men, Marshall, lamented their dismal condition. He wrote that he wouldn't even wish this on his worst enemies to spend time where they were so far removed from human civilization. Perhaps further away, he thought, than any other human had been from civilization since civilizations emerged. As they took account of where they were, they estimated that they were around 250 miles away from the pole, and that at their current rate of progress, it would take them over a month to reach the pole and return to their current spot. But they only had 1 month's food supply. Despite this, Shackleton pressed on, believing against the odds that they could make it still. By the new year, the prospect of failing to reach the pole was again starting to be more likely. The men were suffering intensely. They were malnourished, the cold had cut their faces, and they were starting to suffer from altitude sickness after they had reached 11,000 feet above sea level. While the target of the pole became closer with each step, they increased their chances of not making it back. As each step towards the pole took them away from their closest depot with food. But Shackleton refused to give up. By the 4th of January, they were 150 miles away from the pole. Shackleton roused the men to not accept defeat and to keep going. On the 9th of January, after an unbelievable defiance of the adverse conditions in a 10-hour trek, the frostbitten men had no option but to turn back. They weren't going to make it. Still, they had got 360 miles closer to the pole than any other previous attempt. Turning back, however, was no guarantee of survival. Over the next few days, they had to march back over the treacherous glacier and hope they could make it to their last depot. Shackleton himself was becoming weaker and weaker. He forced himself to walk, but at times he had to be dragged on the sledge, as he had done on Scott's expedition. As they slogged on, their food stocks that they were carrying ran lower and lower. At one point, they went nearly 2 days without solid food. Finally, on the 28th of January, they reached their last depot and could restock. Their timing was fortunate, as only a few hours later, a fierce blizzard made the landscape unnavigable. One of the men, Marshall, thought that if this weather had come before they arrived at the depot, it would have been unlikely that they ever would have made it. It was now late January and they had endured weeks and weeks of hardship. All of them were suffering from dysentery, hunger, cold, and exhaustion. They desperately needed to make it back to their ship, the Nimrod. It was due to leave on the 1st of March, with or without them. Shackleton had given the orders before he left for the pole. If they were not back by the 1st of March, they were to be considered dead. Less than 4 miles away from the ship, the men abandoned their sledge and all of their equipment. They were in a race against time to make it back to the Nimrod. On board, they were already thought to have died. They had taken enough food to last 3 months, but at this point, they had been gone 4 months. They surely couldn't be alive. As a few of the men on board considered forming a party to search for the bodies of Shackleton and the other men, Shackleton and the other men were giving it their all, marching back through the snow. They managed to reach the hut where they had stayed before the trek south, and it was within sight of the ship. From the hut, they took a flag and waved it furiously in view of the ship. They had to let those on board know that they were alive. It was only Shackleton and Frank Wilde who made it back to the ship. Both Marshall and Adams were left behind on land. Now that the ship wasn't going to leave, Shackleton arranged a search party for the two men. Instead of resting and despite his chronic fatigue and near starvation, Shackleton thought it was his duty as a leader to lead the party in search of the two men, who were quickly found. When all said and done, while they failed to reach the South Pole, the Nimrod expedition could hardly be considered a failure. Not a single man died despite the extreme conditions. They were the first to summit Mount Erebus. They reached further south on the globe than any previous human, and they discovered the magnetic South Pole. Their trip back to England ended in June 1909, where Shackleton was celebrated as a celebrity explorer. He dined with high society and was asked to give lectures on his travels. Roald Amundsen, the famous Norwegian explorer, was enthralled with Shackleton and admired his efforts. In December, Shackleton was knighted by Edward VII for his leadership and achievements on the Nimrod expedition. He was now Sir Ernest Shackleton. But it wasn't enough for Shackleton. He needed to reach the pole. But it wasn't just him. Scott and Amundsen wanted to get there first and were planning expeditions themselves. The race was on. But Shackleton wasn't to win the race. Both Scott and Amundsen set off on expeditions before Shackleton could. On the 25th of January, 1912, Amundsen and his party were the first people to reach the South Pole, where they planted the Norwegian flag. The news reached England in March. Shackleton wrote that Amundsen was perhaps the greatest polar explorer in the Daily Mail after reading the news that he had reached the pole. Shackleton was clearly encouraged by this achievement, and he had started planning his next expedition. In recruiting men for this new expedition, Shackleton is reported to have placed an advert in a newspaper which read, "Men wanted for hazardous journey. Low wages, bitter cold, long hours of complete darkness. Safe return doubtful. Honour and recognition in event of success." This advert is just as famous as the man himself, although it has, at the time of this recording, not yet been verified to have actually existed. Almost immediately, two of the men who followed Shackleton on the Nimrod expedition signed up, Frank Wilde and George Marston. With the prize of reaching the pole first already claimed by Amundsen, Shackleton was seeking another, as yet unachieved feat, to be the first to navigate coast to coast across the entire continent of Antarctica. In January 1914, Shackleton found a new ship for the expedition. It was called Polaris, but he immediately renamed it to Endurance, which he had wanted to do for the Nimrod, but didn't. Perhaps because of that old sailor's superstition that renaming a ship was bad luck. Clearly this time, Shackleton chose to ignore this myth. Just at the start of World War I, on August the 8th, 1914, the Endurance sailed from Plymouth on what was called the Imperial Transantarctic Expedition. It took until December when they started to reach the first pack ice in the waters of the Weddell Sea. The pack ice slowed their progress dramatically. On the 14th of December, they were stopped in place completely by the ice. After around 24 hours being frozen in place, they managed to get free and continue sailing. But 3 days later, they were again trapped by the ice. After getting free again, they managed to navigate further south, and for the next few weeks avoided getting stuck. Continuing south, in January, they reached 300 foot high ice walls off an as yet unnamed area, which Shackleton named the Kahn Coast, after one of the financial backers of the project, James Kahn. A few days later, on the 18th of January, the Endurance got stuck in pack ice again, after a period of particularly bad weather. This time, it wasn't going to get unstuck. A few days passed before Shackleton and the men on board the ship started to consider that they might have to wait a prolonged amount of time for the ice to thaw and free the ship. Shackleton ordered that the men do all they could to free the ship. They desperately tried to hammer away at the ice with pickaxes, but it was to no avail. The ship remained frozen in place. Despite being frozen, however, the ship was still moving southwards because the ice itself was drifting further south. With the prospect of potentially months being stranded, Shackleton, ever the pragmatist, focused on ensuring the crew's survival. He instituted a strict rationing system and prioritised maintaining the men's health and morale. This was Shackleton's moment. His leadership over the time the men were stuck on the pack ice was going to mean the difference between life and death. As the ice tightened its grip on the Endurance, Shackleton realised that there was a danger of the boilers exploding, which could have happened if the ice breached the ship's hull. So he ordered the fires to be put out and the boilers to be drained. In doing so, he prevented any loss of life that might have occurred from the explosion. As the weeks turned into months and the prospect of never getting home started to dawn on the men, Shackleton never faltered in his optimism that the men, all 28 of them, were going to survive and they were going to make it back to Britain, back home. Shackleton recognised the importance of maintaining an optimistic outlook and nurtured high morale amongst his men. To that end, he ensured that the men stuck to a routine that enabled them to feel normal. This included simple things like eating meals at the same time each day, and he ensured that the men had regular haircuts. Following meals, the men would often play games or sing songs. In one instance, they played a full game of 11-a-side football on the ice near the ship, in the middle of what to the outside observer seems like a hopeless situation. Thomas orders Lee, one of the men trapped on the ice with Shackleton, wrote that we seem to be a wonderfully happy family. But I think Sir Ernest is the real secret of our unanimity. Shackleton's leadership had cultivated a collective sense of purpose and meaning. Despite his own worries that they might not make it off the frozen continent alive, he did not waver in displaying an encouraging optimism in his men. Over 5 months had passed since the Endurance had become stuck. During that time, the pack ice, the men, and the ship had drifted ever further northwards. Hundreds of miles north, in fact. And by August, the men's hope of the Endurance being freed from the pack ice was buoyed by this movement. But this movement came with increased pressures against the ship. As more ice moved, the force against the hull of the ship changed. The men heard the groaning and creaking of the wood. They hoped the ship would be free before the pressure crushed the hull. By October the 15th, their hopes were finally realised. The Endurance was unfrozen and floating once more. But the boat was still surrounded by pack ice. Only a few days later, the floating sheets of ice were moving, forcing themselves with an almighty pressure against the sides of the ship. The pressure was such that the ship was lifted up. The ice caused a leak in the hull, which the men desperately tried to patch. They did not lose hope. They worked tirelessly trying to pump the water off the ship. But by the 27th of October, it was clear that the ship was not going to make it. Shackleton was forced to give the order to abandon the ship. Each man was allowed to take 2 pounds of their possessions from the ship before they left it, forever. There would need to be light to march back to the civilized world. Back out onto the cold, windswept ice they went. Shackleton gathered the men round and vowed that he would get them all home safe. They prepared to march across the treacherous ice. They will be heading northwest to several known bases with food. One of them was on Snow Island. It was closest to them, but even then it was 300 miles away. Frank Worsley thought that the march was too risky and that they should instead wait for the ice to move. Shackleton decided it was their best option and that he ordered all of the animals that were weak to be shot, including the ship's cat, Mrs. Chippy. They set off on Saturday the 30th of October, dragging all their supplies, including the lifeboats from the ship, on sledges. Led by Shackleton, the men were in high spirits, but it was arduous work. With the weight of their supplies and the difficult ice terrain, after 2 hours, they had only made it a mile. The next day was no easier again. They only made it a mile. In the same time, however, the ice that they were travelling on had made it 6 miles north. 3 miles a day. The next day, Shackleton realised the folly of this march and abandoned it. They would camp and wait until the ice broke up, which would allow them to sail away in their lifeboats. The scarcely 2 miles that they had marched meant the ship was still so close as to be able to see it. That is, until the 21st of November, when Shackleton saw that the ship was about to sink for good. "She's going, boys," he shouted, and they all saw as she was swallowed by the ice. For Shackleton, the biggest threat of being stationary on the ice was the breakdown of the men's spirits. He encouraged optimism to the point of delusion and chastised anyone who expressed pessimistic or even realistic views that deviated from his optimistic vision. In one instance, Thomas Orders Lee reasonably expressed doubts that they would make it home for Christmas, which was less than 2 months away. Ordus Lee wrote that he ended up in pretty hot water with Shackleton because of this. But it was difficult to keep the spirits of the men up when they were hostage to the elements and forced to camp in the same spot. Time went by and soon Christmas was upon them. Shackleton decided that they would start another attempt at a march northwards, which seems mainly to have been to give the men hope and a target to aim for. They celebrated Christmas on the 22nd of December, so that they could start the march on the 23rd. Each man was allowed as much food as he could eat, which fueled them for the march and also greatly improved their mood. The morning of the march came. Shackleton and the men started to move north. The softness of the ground and the mush of the ice and snow from the never-setting sun made their progress slower than it had been on their last attempt. It took them 8 hours to move just over a mile. They went to bed exhausted, and the next day they managed to trek just over 3 miles. While the idea of the march had raised the spirits of the men, the lack of progress had caused resentment among the men. Some had mutinous intent. One of the men, McNeish, tried to argue that as the endurance had sunk, there was no longer the official ranking of the men that came with the ship. Shackleton responded to this threat by gathering the men around, calmly reading the ship's articles to them, to which they had all agreed by coming on the expedition. He argued that despite the sinking of the ship, the articles still applied. And in a tactful move, he pointed out that this meant the men were still going to be getting wages. It was a simple tactic, but it worked to stall McNeish's attempt at overthrowing Shackleton. A few days later, Shackleton ordered this new march to stop. While they had lasted longer and got further, it was no use. They made little progress, and it had cost them dearly in effort. They set up a new camp, a camp which Shackleton named Patience Camp. It was an apt name, for they would spend the next 3 months here, waiting. The ice on which they camped continued to drift northwards until in mid-March they finally sighted land. It was James Ross Island. This was the first time that the men had seen land in some 5 months. They had planned to set sail in the lifeboats. But Shackleton had a change of heart at the last minute and decided to wait more. At the end of March, they had moved still further on the ice, and Shackleton was making plans to either make a break for Clarence or Elephant Island, both of which were around 100 miles north. The ice floe that they were camping on was getting smaller and smaller, and cracks were starting to appear in the ice. The time to attempt a crossing in the lifeboats was getting closer. On April the 9th, Shackleton decided that they were to set sail. They navigated through the blocks of ice until it went dark, when they set up camp on a floe of ice. Near midnight, Shackleton woke the men. The ice on which they were encamped had begun to crack. The ice started to move apart rapidly, leading one of the men to fall into the freezing water, still in his sleeping bag. Luckily, he was spotted almost immediately and pulled out of the water to safety. The next few days were hell. They were exposed to the elements on the open sea as they attempted to make land. They rowed their way through more blocks of ice with Captain Worsley navigating. After nearly a full week on the open sea, with all of the men suffering from exhaustion, most with dysentery, and some, like Captain Worsley, with a level of tiredness beyond words after having not slept for some 40 hours, they finally stepped ashore on Elephant Island. solid land offered them much needed rest and shelter from their ordeal. They spent nearly 10 days resting before Shackleton formed a party of 6 men who would be tasked with taking one of the lifeboats and braving through the rough, windswept seas once more in order to travel the near 800 miles to the nearest known humans at a whaling depot on South Georgia Island. Shackleton and the 5 other men, including Captain Worsley, battled for 17 days against enormous waves. They somehow made it to South Georgia Island, only to land on the wrong side of the island. Worsley had originally planned to land on the north side of the island where the whaling station was. But before they arrived, Shackleton expressed doubts about sailing around the island. There was a slim margin for error. If Worsley's original course had been slightly inaccurate, there was a good chance that they would have been swept out to the open sea. Shackleton decided not to risk it. But now, between them and the whaling station, were enormous mountains. Of the 6 men that made the crossing, 3 were in a bad way. None of them had drank any water for over 48 hours, which led to their tongues swelling. Shackleton decided that the 3 in the worst condition would wait in a camp they set up which used their lifeboat. They called the camp Peggotty Camp, in reference to the Charles Dickens novel David Copperfield, in which the character Peggotty has a house made out of a boat. For Shackleton and the 2 other men, Worsley and Tom Crean, who were less fatigued than the others, their task was now to pave an as yet unknown route across the mountains of South Georgia, a feat which no human had done before. As this was April, the winter of the Southern Hemisphere would make their trek even more dangerous. Shackleton thought that they would need well over a day of continuous marching in order to reach the whaling station. The weather held them back for several attempts. But at 2 a.m. on a morning under a full moon, Shackleton led Worsley and Crean on the first steps of the trek. It would be an arduous journey, and they wouldn't get a chance to rest until they made it to the whaling station. Shackleton ordered the men to leave behind their reindeer sleeping bags. This was mainly to save weight on the trip, but it also enforced crossing without sleep. After they had trekked nearly all the hours of sunlight, they reached an ice-covered ridge, with mist and fog coming down, as well as the dwindling light fading. They couldn't see the bottom. They were worried that they would become trapped on the ridge in the darkness. So Shackleton came up with a risky idea. They would slide down the ice ridge. They didn't know it, but it was some 1,500 feet to the bottom. Shackleton took the lead and sat in front of the men as they prepared to slide down into the unknown. They slid for around 3 minutes and managed to reach the bottom unscathed, apart from ripped trousers, which they laughed about. As darkness fell and the full moon rose again to guide them, they made their way completely exhausted, closer and closer to the whaling station. Shackleton was leading the men in demonstrating the limits of human endurance. After another few hours marching, they came across another obstacle. This was a 30-foot high waterfall that they needed to get down. They were so close to the whaling station now that they decided to abseil down, with Shackleton going first. It had taken over 36 hours of marching with no sleep and few rests for them to reach the whaling station safely. They met the Norwegian men stationed there, who plied them with food and ran the men hot baths. Now the rescue of the other men could begin. Both the men on Elephant Island and the 3 left at Peggotty Camp would need saving. It took until August to rescue all the remaining men. The organisation and procuring of a ship was a problem which Shackleton headed. In the end, all the men survived, which was a remarkable feat of leadership and endurance. Shackleton arrived back in England in May 1917. He had been away for nearly 4 years, yet he was not tired of adventure. Now 42 years old enough to be exempt from the new conscription in Britain for the war, he nevertheless volunteered to go and join the war effort. His first mission involved travelling to Russia, but it never materialised. He then tried to get to the front lines in France and Italy, but he didn't manage to be sent. He did manage to get sent to Buenos Aires. As part of the war effort, he was tasked with persuading the Argentinians and Chileans to enter the war on the Allied side. He was unsuccessful in this task. After South America, Shackleton did actually get sent to Russia, but not as part of World War I. Instead, this was to serve as a major in the Russian Civil War. But what Shackleton yearned for was the Antarctic. After the Russian Civil War, he spent time lecturing, mainly in London, to half-sold-out theatres. It was clear that he was bored by this, and he started to drink more. The Antarctic had an irresistible pull for Shackleton, and soon he was planning and arranging the financing for another expedition. Although he originally planned to go to the Arctic, the plan changed, and once more he set his sights on the Antarctic. He convinced a man called John Quillier Rovett to fund the expedition. Shackleton found a ship for the journey called the Quest. It would prove to be Shackleton's final adventure. He suffered a heart attack on board the Quest near South Georgia, the island on which he had once sought refuge. He was 47 years old when he died, on the 5th of January 1922. His wife Emily, upon hearing the news, wanted Shackleton to be buried on South Georgia, because he was never at home in England. The Antarctic was his home and his final resting place. Ernest Shackleton was one of the greatest adventurers of the great age of polar exploration, but he is most famous for his leadership throughout the Endurance expedition. He and the crew found themselves in a hopeless situation. Surviving their circumstances was long odds. But Shackleton defied the improbable. No, he defied the impossible. 800 miles from the nearest human, across frozen deserts, relentless waters and unforgiving mountains, Ernest Shackleton led the 27 members of his crew and himself to safety. Not a single man was lost. He died attempting another polar adventure at the age of 47. When he died, he left behind an enduring legacy of leadership, survival, and endurance. Shackleton once said, "It is in our nature to explore, to reach out into the unknown. The only true failure will be to not explore at all." Thank you for listening to this episode of the Enduring Lives podcast. If you want to see the other episodes or the show notes for this episode, go to enduringlives.com. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. And subscribe if you want to get the latest episodes when they're released. I've been your host, Shane Lee. Thank you for listening. Until next time.